You are listening to The Bell Post.
Welcome to the first episode of a new podcast. My name is Ken W. Good. I'm an attorney in Texas specializing in bail law. Our goal for this podcast is to discuss issues relating to criminal justice reform and bail reform. In the last few years, we've seen a push for reform that began in our urban areas. And from California to New York, there were different changes that were made, which I think now we would even agree that those were failures. There were bad bail reform and examples of bad criminal justice reform. As we have seen crime increasing over the last year, my hope is that we can find common ground in discussing what works and why certain reforms do not seem to be effective. I hope that you can find the podcast informative and start discussing these issues and other questions that can arise. And on today's episode, we'll be discussing the topic of what the heck do bondsmen do? And we have three guests with us that are all bondsmen. We have Cindy Hammonds from Brazoria County, Angleton, Texas, and she's the owner of Cindy's Bail Bonds. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Thank you, Ken.
Cindy, how long have you been a bondsman?
21 years, sir.
Great. Next, we have Corey Lee from Taylor County, Abilene, Texas, and he's the owner of Bad Boy Bail Bonds in Taylor County and other counties. Welcome to the show, Corey. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
And how long have you been a bondsman?
Started out working for my grandfather when I was high school, but I opened my own business about 12 years ago.
And then we have John McCluskey from Harris County, Houston, Texas, the owner of A-Action Bail Bonds. Welcome to the show, John. How long have you been a bondsman?
I've been a bondsman about 32 years.
So if my math is correct, we have on our show today over 60 years of experience from the bonding community. So let's see what we can learn from this aggregate years of experience. I guess my first question is, how did you become a bondsman or why did you become a bondsman? John, you seem to be the oldest bondsman among us.
Well, how I became a bondsman was I started working for a bond company and decided that I could do it better than they could. So I went out on my own, and that's how I originally started Action Bail Bonds right here in Houston, Texas. And I, at the time, lived in Dallas, Texas.
What's the process? I know there's two different types of counties. What kind of county is Harris County, and how do you get licensed there?
Okay, Harris County is what we call a bail bond board county. It's any county. A bail bond board county is any county that's got 110,000 population or greater. And it's governed by a bail bond board under the Occupational Code 1704. And like I said, these counties are called bail bond board counties.
So to get licensed, you have to have a year's work experience and you have to have a continuing education. Cindy, where did you get your work experience?
My work experience, well, I started out 23 years ago working for a young lady that didn't know what she was doing. So it's kind of like same thing that happened with John. I worked for her for a couple of years and then got into the business on my own as I saw she was breaking all the rules and have been doing it ever since.
But we've talked about bail bond board counties. We also have criminal code counties. Does anyone, Corey, do you ride in criminal code counties?
I do.
And how is that different from bail bond board?
It's ran mostly just by the sheriff. He pretty much calls all the shots. Instead of there being a board, it pretty much falls back on either him and or his, you know, his right-hand man. But he makes most all the shots calls.
Well, I mean, we've talked about how you become licensed to become a bail bondsman. You know, I think kind of chronologically, the next step is, you know, once you become approved to write bonds, what's the process you go through in deciding whether you want to write a bond? Cindy, what process do you go through?
I go through many, many, many questions to the defendant, the co-signer. Are you a U.S. citizen? Are you on probation or parole? What are your priors? Where do you live? Do you have a car to get to and from court? I try to look up priors in other counties to see if they have any prior bond forfeitures or failures to appear elsewhere that I'm not aware of. just many, many questions go into the mix on making that decision.
Corey, do you always have a co-signer on a bond?
Not always. It just depends on the situation we go through and evaluate. The risk on the person as far as if they're local, if they're from here, if they have a job helps a lot. Like Cindy said, if they have adequate transportation to and from court, all that determines whether or not we're going to need a co-signer.
One of the things Cindy mentioned is whether they're a U.S. citizen. John, why is that important?
Well, if they're extradited or they're sent back to Mexico, we have no real way of having the case adjudicated. So it puts us at risk for the total amount of the bond with no way to mitigate it where we're concerned as a bondsman.
Well, I think that's an important point that I don't know if everybody understands. When we're posting a bond, when we're making the decision to post a bond, when we're making a decision about whether we're going to be at risk for paying the full amount of the bond if they don't show up and they don't ever come back. I think there's many situations that people don't realize. Like if the defendant is from a different state and it's a misdemeanor, he's passing through your county and gets charged with misdemeanor theft, is that usually a bond that you would write, Cindy?
I would normally ask for cash collateral on something like that. If they're from out of state, our county charges 60% of the bond. So I request 60% cash collateral to cover what my county would charge me should they not return for court.
Well, what's the increased risk if it's a misdemeanor and they live in a different state? Corey, is there an increased risk?
There is. Crossing state lines, there's no extradition, say, between Texas and, say, Oklahoma, just right across the river. Once they get across the river, they're scot-free on a misdemeanor. There's no way to get them back here. We can't actually legally apprehend them and bring them back.
So what you're saying is that Texas does not extradite from other states people who are just charged on misdemeanors.
Correct.
And so if someone's charged with a misdemeanor and they decide to go to another state, you have no way to force them to come back because Texas has made a policy decision that if it's a misdemeanor only, they will not bring them back to Texas to answer for that charge.
That's correct.
So, John, what do you do in that situation? I mean, Cindy said you require a lot of collateral up front. What else can you do?
There's not much else you can do. And normally, if we don't have somebody that's very stable, willing to co-sign on the bond, or we get collateral, we do not do them. Action Bail Bonds does not.
Well, if you, what other options do you have other than just trying to convince them on their own to come back? Anything else? Anybody?
Really.
Cindy?
No, sir. To convince them to come back, I try not to let it get that far to begin with. I normally will charge collateral or I will advise them that they can also do a cash bond if that's an avenue they want to take as well, instead of putting up collateral.
Well, are there any types of crimes or any types of charges that you just will not write as a bondsman, John?
Yes. Normally I will not do a capital murder bond. If they get out, they really do have a tendency to run. And because the chances of them on a capital murder case of getting off just scot-free, or when I say scot-free, with probation or something of that nature is almost doesn't exist. So I don't even take the risk with it.
Corey, any bonds that you want right?
Well, pretty much what John just said, something that's going to risk them spending the rest of their lives in prison. We really need to evaluate those to make sure we are certain that we can get them back here. Not just about losing the money, but there's also victims that are involved in this. And the last thing you want to do is be able to let this person get, like John said, scot-free. And we lose them. We don't need that. They need to pay for what they've done if they're guilty.
You know, it seems like over time there's charges that change that we may have written 10 years ago that we won't write anymore. It seems like to me that there was a time where someone was accused of doing something with a child. The stigma of that. It was those at one time seemed to be pretty safe bonds. There was a greater risk of them committing suicide than running, but that doesn't seem true anymore. Are there any charges that you used to write that you don't want to write anymore, or you don't write anymore, Cindy?
No, not. I consider everything. But I'm with John and Corey on the capital murder, something like that, that they're looking at time regardless. It's very high risk.
Well, once you post a bond, what are your expectations for that person after they're out on your bond? Corey, what do you normally require?
Well, we have an app on their smartphone that they're required to check in with me weekly. It gives them any day, any time that they want to do it, as long as it's done once every 7 days. They are required to do that. It tells me their GPS location when they check in. It takes a selfie, so I know it's them. And it also shows me where they go. Every day it pings their phone 5-6 times. So I kind of see a tracker to where they are. So my deal is I'm trying to keep up with the defendant, even when they don't know I'm keeping up with them. And so that way, if something does go awry and they decide they don't want to come back and see us, I'm going to have a good idea where to find them.
Well, it seems like a lot of times these people are nomads, and sometimes they change cell phones quickly. Do you find that they lose or get new phones frequently?
They do. And what we had in the beginning with the app was they would delete the app and then call us back the following week to get the app re-downloaded and set it all back up. And so we fix that to where they're not allowed to do that anymore. They come check in person once a week if they start doing that. So they'll get one chance to re-download the app. Or if they quit checking in, now they have to check in person in my office once a week on Wednesdays between 9 and 5, or whatever day at the time I pick it for them to come in.
Cindy, what is your expectations once you post a bond for someone?
They have to come into my office immediately when they're released from jail and fill out all their paperwork, their contract, along with the co-signer. And then we have them call in once a week or text once a week as well. Some people with higher bonds or riskier bonds, we have them check in person more than once a month. And that's how we keep up with them. When we're not hearing from them, we're calling them. And that's how we determine who we need to be watching for,
John, do you have what determines in your office the distinction between call-in check-ins or in-person check-ins?
Well, to make a general statement, a misdemeanor bond, they can call in. A felony bond that's $10,000 or above must walk in our office once a week. Like Cindy, if it's a weak bond and a weak case, then we may have them check in twice a week and sign in. We have a card that they must sign. What we do when they come in is we get their current driver's license, even though we've already got it, and we double check where they live and what their phone numbers are. In the event that we've had a problem with them, we call their co-signers and their references that they've put on their application. If I have a problem with them, then I have to take it to the next step.
Getting references or family, a list of family members, how important is that in posting a risky bond? Cindy, do you do that?
Oh, absolutely. I require at least 5 friends and the entire family, children, phone numbers, addresses, all of it. Because you never know. One of those people may not want to talk, but the other one will. It's very important to have that information.
Corey, why is that information important?
We're required to get the defendant back to court when they summon them. So we need to be able to get a hold of them. If we can't get a hold of them, we need to get a hold of a family member. We need to locate them. So let's just say they do decide they want to abscond. And the first thing we're going to do is start calling people that know them, because obviously we don't know them very well. So we start calling all those family members and friends and reaching out to them as much as we can until we finally get a hold of the defendant. Either we have them in custody or we have them in court.
One of the things that I think gets lost in the discussion about, bail is, that a bond, once it's posted, it usually in Texas says instanter on it. So it doesn't have a specific court date and time for you to appear. It says instanter, which is a Latin phrase, but it really just means that you're on standby outside the courtroom at any time for the court to call you in to have a hearing. And so it's almost like the court has turned over the process of giving notice to court dates or court hearings to the bonding community, because they don't have to give you notice. You're always supposed to be on standby. So what is it that y'all do to make sure that a defendant knows their court dates and that they're prepared to go when the court wants them? John?
Well, first of all, on Mondays, or actually Sunday afternoons, we run a court date report, which gives us everybody that has court the following week, this coming week, or the following week. So we make one phone call to them then. The night before, the people that have court the next day, we start calling them. And if we can't contact the defendant, then that's when we go through the process, which we just discussed, that we call their co-signers, their references, their boss, to verify their work and things of that nature.
Cindy, what do you do to make sure people know when their court date is?
Well, it's the same with John. When they call in, every time they check in, we remind them of their court date. We just kind of burn it into their brain. And then the same thing, we run a court report at the beginning of the week and we start getting a hold of people, but we always call the very night before as well. So they may get one or two notices via the phone or text that they have a court date. And then on the mornings of court, I make it to the courtroom for the docket call to make sure that everyone's there, because if someone's not and you just spoke to them the night before, the judge will allow us to get them in there, you know, give us about a week before they'll issue a warrant. So we just have to keep up with them, stay on them.
Corey, you mentioned that you use an app for reporting. Do you use the app for giving people notice of their court dates or making sure they know when they're supposed to be in court?
I do.
How do you do that?
Our app, basically what happens, as soon as we get a court date, we'll put it into our system that we use. It's a Bell software system that's tied into our app as well. So as soon as they check in once a week, they get a push notification of their court date. So it may be 6 months down the road, but every time they check in, they know about their court date. So they're getting it for 6 months. We also send them out a text the week before their court date and then a text the day before their court date.
How important do you think these reminders of telling them when they need to go to court, how important are those to getting people to actually show up for court? Cindy?
Oh, it's the very most important thing. The reminders, the constant calling and reminding of court dates. You know, and another thing is that the court dates are constantly changing. They're getting reset, you know, before they ever even set a foot into a courtroom. They have appearance after appearance. So it's not just one court date you're keeping up with. You're keeping up with a series of court dates. So they have to be updated constantly. You know, as soon as they've seen the inside of a courtroom, you have to update their next appearance and make sure you remind them of that one, too.
John, do you think the bonding community and reminding defendants of their court dates is making a difference?
Yes, I would say that's the reason our failure to appear rate is 5 or 6%, and all other types of bonding has something around 50 to 60% failure to appear. And I believe that the primary reason is we have families involved, and we're able to call these people over and over and over again, and we have that family tie that gets them to court. That's the big difference.
Well, and I think also, you know, when you have a long-term relationship with these people, you're talking to them, you remind them of the court dates. I think you also develop a relationship with the defendant so that they trust you. So if they mess up, they can rely upon what you're telling them as what to expect. Is that what you found, Cindy?
Oh, yes. My clients love that I go to court with them because they, you know, some of them are scared. They don't know what's going to happen. So I can kind of give them a little introduction to, you know, courtroom etiquette and this is what's going to happen when you walk in there, and, you know, they won't be so scared. That it's a big, huge part of it.
Okay. So we've talked about getting people to court. We talked about or bonding somebody out. We talked about getting them notices of their court setting. But what happens when someone fails or stops reporting to you, or you've got family members that say, I don't want to be an indemnitor anymore, or they say, hey, I'm concerned. They're back to using drugs, or they're about to run. What are your options, Corey, at that point?
The first thing we do, once we talk to, say it's an indemnitor that wants off, they have to come in my office and bring me in an affidavit to sign stating why. And it can't be something like, well, we got into a fight or something like that. It needs to be a legitimate reason. And if they're fear for them, like their life because they're back on drugs or something, we put that on the affidavit to turn into a judge so we can get a warrant. But before we go get the warrant, the first thing we do is we try to get hold of the defendant just to make sure that the stories match up, because, you know, we have indemnitors who come in, they're just upset. Well, I went off this bond, or I'm afraid I might lose money, or, you know, for some other reason. So the first thing we do is we try to get all parties together to try to figure out what exactly is going on before we just run out and start getting warrants for people, because, you know, this person may be doing right and they just may not be getting along at the time or something like that. But let's say it is true. Then, yeah, that's the first thing we do is we go up to the judge, we request a warrant for the defendant if we can't get a hold of them. And then we start looking for them that day.
John, you know, are you able very often to rehabilitate, you know, these situations where they can continue on bond?
It's amazing that we do. Just because of the relationship not only we have with the defendant, because they have to come to our office or we talk to them so much, but also their co-signers and their family members that we've built some type of relationship with, that really does help rehabilitate this urge for them just not show up. And many of them will come to us and say, do I have a warrant? Am I going to be safe? Are they going to put me in jail? We can answer all of those questions up front. And like Cindy, if we have one, and of course, I have a number of people on bond, but we will go to court with them just to give them that security that we're going to be there. So if they were arrested, or if there is an issue, we're there to stand up for them or redo the bond.
All right.
Yeah, get a friend in their corner.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, you know, I think one of the most important things that bondsmen maybe even have a bad rap about is when someone fails to appear for court. You know, I think what gets lost is probably a large percentage of people who fail to show up for court. Because of our relationship with them, we can overcome their fear and get them back in the system pretty quickly. Corey, is that how you feel like it works normally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as soon as we can get a hold of them, I mean, it's like they were saying, we'll go up to court with them. I'll drive them up to court. I've driven people a long ways to court just to make sure they get there. A couple of hours, actually. Whatever we need to do to get them there to get it taken care of, I mean, that's our sole purpose.
Cindy, what is your practice when you have a failure to appear?
Well, I immediately start looking for them. You know, and the best thing to do is contact the co-signer first, because they have the most to lose, you know. But you just never know why they fail to appear. There could be many reasons, issues that couldn't be helped, you know. Instead of just getting them arrested, I want to get to the bottom of the reason why they didn't show up, and if there's a way we can fix it without them having to be rearrested. You know, we can always walk them in and get a reset with the judge. That's my main goal, is to make sure that everybody's taken care of. And some people, they'll lose their ride at the last minute, or things happen, you know.
John, what excuse do you hear the most about why someone failed to appear?
Well, they first start off with, I forgot when my court date was, which we can nullify that simply because of our records. And what we do is we keep record of that. Every time we call them, you know, we list who we talked to, or a message that we left, or if we got no answer at all. So that's probably the easiest way. I mean, the other is I don't have a ride. That's a big issue in some of these cases. And I think you take care of a lot of that in the pre-application process, as you're taking the bond in, as you're finding out how they get around, if they own a car, if they have parents, or they're living with somebody that's got a car, or married to somebody that's got a car. That really helps. If they have no car and they have no transportation, your chances of them failing to appear in court at some time are very high.
Let me ask this question. So, I mean, you know, we have some bonds that where they decide not to show up and they are on the run. Do you feel like those are one-offs, or do you feel like that if you look back at the file, you can see some red flags that either you missed or they stopped checking in? But what's your perception of how that goes down, Corey?
We do try to weed most all of that out as soon as possible. You know, at the very beginning, we ask who, what, when, where, why, and how. We go through all of that, just like Cindy was saying earlier. But yeah, there's been maybe a couple of times I've looked back and said, we didn't realize he was from Mississippi. But I mean, that's something that we catch 99% of all of those, I think, and shut it down beforehand. I think a lot of people that fail to appear, some of them intend to. They're just like, I'm not going to court no matter what. And there's no way that we could weed that out.
We all have, I mean, I think all bondsmen have that one bond that you wrote, they went on the run, and either it was very difficult finding them or you didn't find them. I mean, looking back upon one of those examples right now, what do you think was the, was there something that kind of gave it away, or did you just miss it? John?
I would say where they're from. And when you find out about their family, and if they're from Mississippi, the family's from Mississippi, and this guy gets in trouble again, and he fears that he's going to go back to jail, he goes to Mississippi. And I think that's one of the keys that we try to key in on. Where are your folks? Where are you from? How long have you lived there? Where's your wife from? I mean, if they're all from different parts of the country, then it's a crapshoot.
Do you think it could have been a good bond at the time you wrote it, and then it went south? Like, they started using drugs again, they got in a bad situation?
That could be. Yeah, absolutely. That happens all the time. You know, you get somebody that starts falling further off the deep end, and then you got to start, you know, doing some backtracking and checking out your risk and keeping a good eye on them, you know.
We've already had somebody mention that, you know, we have the lowest failure to appear rate of all the other types of pretrial release. We've had some people come out and say, hey, we can just send everybody text notifications reminding them of their court date. And that will do the same. We'll have the same result. Do you think that'll work, John?
No.
Why?
Well, I believe our personal contact is what makes the biggest difference. The ones that you text, or you send emails to with the court dates, most of those people are going to go to court. They may just forget it. And this is just a reminder. Those that you're going to have a problem with is a little deeper. And I'd like to address just a little bit more of what we do with one when we recognize we have a problem. When we do get in contact with a defendant, we ask them to come to the office and we re-verify the bond. For instance, if we find out that the cosigner is not working anymore, the phone number doesn't work, we get another cosigner. If we find out that the references, that the numbers don't work, we make them get us new references. So that's the way we try to keep up with those, if you will, problem alerts. We start seeing this and not being able to check in, not calling us back when we call them, having their cosigners not call us back when we call them. Those are all big signs that we go that on our call sheet, that's what's brought to my desk to determine what we should do with it.
Okay. So what I hear you saying is that because, you know, these are nomads, people who are mobile, they don't have any ties to the community. Sometimes they don't have jobs. What I hear you saying is if you just send a text and that's all you're relying upon, the way they change phones and the way they move around, they're going to lose that text, or they're not going to be receiving that text very soon after they're released from jail.
Or they get that text and they get that notice and they don't want to accept it. They may see it, but they may say, well, I didn't get it.
Yeah, it's easier for them to do that, to ignore a text message as opposed to a voice over the phone. Right. I agree. Yeah.
You know, we've talked a lot about today about, you know, the different processes that we go through or that y'all go through in writing bail and keeping up with people. What do you think the biggest misconception about bondsmen is today, Corey?
One of the funniest things I hear is, you're like Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Well,
I'm sure they've heard this before, too.
That's important because bondsmen can't rearrest in Texas.
I know. You have to have a PI license.
Have to have a PI license. So that means we can go find them, but we can't arrest them. So we can locate them and then call either a private investigator or a policeman.
But yeah, as far as like the misconceptions go, I think that's one of them is that Hollywood standard version of what a bail bond person looks like. And nothing against Doc the Bounty Hunter, but I would say most of us don't walk around macing people and wearing leather jackets. So it's a little different than what it looks like on TV.
Cindy, what do you think is the biggest misconception about bail bondsmen today?
Well, misconception kind of goes on the same line of what Corey was talking about. I think that I personally have heard people say that we're just money hungry. We don't care about who we get out of jail. You know, we're just there for the money, and that's not true at all. You know, I've got many, many, many clients over the years that have become citizens that are working and doing well, and not everybody is a bad person. You know, they're not all hardened criminals. So
I think just to state that another way, bondsmen are really the heart of giving someone a second chance and making sure that they are walked through the system and fully know what's going on and trying to get them back on the right track.
Correct.
John, what do you think the biggest misconception today is about bondsmen?
Well, I think Cindy and Corey both hit on the two or three things. The big thing that I hear is you guys, all you do is collect money and get them out. Mm-hmm. Okay. You just get anybody out of jail, collect their money, and then you go on. What they don't understand is what we've discussed all day about how we try to keep up with them and how we try to nurture them back to court to adjudicate this case. That gives them the security that if I don't do this again, then I can go on with my life. If they continue to make these mistakes and we just sit here and let them, then they have no reason not go to court.
Well, it seems like, you know, we've hearing, especially out of Harris County recently, that, you know, this increase in crime is really part of the blame is bondsmen. And I find that it's an argument where they're talking out both sides of the mouth. Poor should not be kept in jail, but we're not charging enough. And so we're contributing to the increase of crime. But if you look at everything we've talked about today, the job of the bondsman is to get someone to go to court. And it's almost like courts. If you no longer care whether someone will show up for court because you don't care whether they're ever convicted or found guilty, you don't care about public safety, then you don't need bondsmen. But if you care about someone showing up for court, then you desperately need bondsmen and you want to encourage everyone that you can to get a bondsman to bond them out so that they will be reminded and go to court and the case will get resolved much quicker.
Bondsmen are a spoke in the criminal justice wheel. I mean, we're just one part of it that keeps it rolling.
Yeah,
we actually are the largest entity that works with the criminal justice system that's not actually in the criminal justice system.
Well, and you're saying it nicely. That doesn't cost the taxpayers a dime.
Exactly. It's free to the taxpayers.
We keep saying, we need to go to the federal system. The federal system is a detainer release system. But in the federal system, 70%, there's a presumption that 70% of the people arrested are detained. Can you imagine the Texas system? If 70% of the people arrested were detained, I mean, we don't have enough jail space for that. And it's almost like our friends on the other side are arguing that we should go to that type of system because they know it can't work. And that way more people will be released because it'll create chaos.
We keep a list of people that we can refer a client to, a defendant to, if they have, you know, if they have anger problems, if they have, alcohol problems, drug problems, their family comes to us and go, you know, I'm just exasperated with them. I don't know what to do. We can give them a list that they can send these loved ones to get help. Where in the county, they just give them one option or two options. That's it. They can only be there for 20 days and then they're out. Doesn't make any difference. And every alcoholic or somebody that has a narcotics problem will tell you 28 days, you can lie your way through 28 days. It just didn't long enough for them to be rehabilitated mentally to get away from whatever this addiction is, regardless of what the addiction.
We do.
We do have a list, and we try to give those to people, but we don't solicit it. We just, if they come to us, then we say, here's a list, here's the phone numbers.
Corey, you were saying something?
Yeah, we do the same thing, just like John said. I mean, we have anywhere from like, you know, Noah's Project here, stuff like that. There are several nonprofits that will come through our office, and they'll leave pamphlets and flyers, and of course, we'll put them up. And when people come in, if they do have issues like that, anger issues, drug issues, that's a big one. You know, we try to get them pointed in the right direction. I mean, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So rehab only works if you want it to, I believe. But we still have those options laying out there. And it's at our office everywhere for people to take pamphlets if they want. You know, I think that's what a lot of people need is, you know, drug rehabilitation outside of the jail.
I guess this will conclude the very first episode of our new podcast regarding criminal justice and bail reform. I want to give a special thanks to our guest, Cindy Hammonds, of Cindy's Bail Bonds out of Brazoria County, and Corey Lee of Bad Boys Bail Bonds out of Taylor County and other counties, and then John McCluskey of A-Action Bail Bonds out of Harris County. Thank you all very much for attending today, and I guess that's it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening, and come back for the next episode of The Bail Post.